Disc 4. When doctors analyzed the drug Tom had taken, they discovered that instead of the opiate-like drug he sought to create, he had inadvertently created another chemical called 1-methyl-4-phenyl-1,2,3,6-tetrahydropyridine, or MPTP. When they injected this into monkeys, they found that it produced a sudden, profound onset of Parkinson's-like disease. This was a first. Until then, no one had ever found a drug that would exactly reproduce Parkinson's disease in experimental animals. These researchers knew that other conditions could produce clinical states similar to Parkinsonism, but they always had other clinical features that made them distinct. For example, manganese poisoning and certain forms of encephalitis can both produce a similar condition, but they have other psychiatric, motor, and sensory findings not seen with pure Parkinson's disease. Following this initial report, doctors in emergency rooms began to see more and more of these young, drug-induced Parkinson's patients. The drug culture coined their own name for the condition, the frozen addict. Researchers, excited with their new discovery, began to study this enigmatic compound extensively. They found that there was a wide variability in an animal's sensitivity to the toxic effects of the compound. Older monkeys appeared to be more sensitive to its toxic effects than were younger animals, and squirrel monkeys were more resistant than rhesus or marmoset monkeys. But in non-human primates, the delay in onset of the full-blown syndrome was 8 to 12 weeks, instead of 2 to 3 days seen in man. There is also some evidence that the Lewy bodies, seen in classic Parkinson's disease, are the result of normal aging of the brain. When MPTP is fed to elderly experimental animals, they also develop Lewy bodies, whereas younger animals do not. It may be that human cases of MPTP poisoning lack Lewy bodies because the majority of victims are so young. Interestingly, when MPTP is given to rodents, very little happens. Most of the animals recover completely from the initial effects. This may be because their brains clear the substance very rapidly, whereas monkeys retain it for weeks. Beagle dogs and cats also recover after initial toxicity. There is considerable variability in the sensitivity of animals of the same species, age, and sex to the same dose of MPTP. Why? No one knows. In man, exposure to MPTP produces advanced Parkinson's disease that is permanent. How MPTP works. MPTP is a very fat-soluble substance that passes through the blood-brain barrier easily and concentrates in the lipids of the brain. There is some evidence that MPTP itself does not directly kill the cells known to be damaged in Parkinson's disease. Instead, MPTP is converted by an enzyme called MAOB into another compound called MPP+. There is some support for this theory based on the observation that drugs that inhibit the converting enzyme MAOB can completely block the toxicity of MPTP in all animal species. Recent studies have shown that the MAOB enzyme is increased in patients with spontaneously occurring Parkinson's disease, Parkinsonism occurring without exposure to MPTP. It may be that the MAOB enzyme increases the neuron's vulnerability to a number of neurotoxins. One of the most promising anti-Parkinson's drugs, Deprenil, may act as a long-lasting MAOB inhibitor. It also acts as a free radical scavenger. In fact, this is the first drug that has been shown actually to slow down the progress of Parkinson's disease in humans. The only other substance shown to slow the course of Parkinson's disease is vitamin E. Remember, vitamin E is a very powerful antioxidant free radical scavenger. In experimental studies, vitamin E has been shown to block completely the effect of excitotoxins on neurons in tissue culture. Unfortunately, it does not offer complete protection in the intact brain in living persons. There is some evidence that MPP+ damages the neurons in the substantia nigra by generating free radicals. It is also known that this toxin can interrupt complex I of the main energy-generating system in the neuron, the electron transport chain in the mitochondria. When it fails, the neurons become especially sensitive to excitotoxin damage. Blocking the complex I system can cause the cell to generate more free radicals, and this can eventually kill the cell. Others have found that MPP+ may act through the excitatory neural system itself. Certain glutamate-blocking drugs, NMDA antagonists, can protect against this toxic effect if administered throughout the entire time MPP+ is within the brain. A recent study done to determine the presence of free radical activation of antioxidant enzymes, enzymes that neutralize these free radicals, was completed using a series of autopsied Parkinson's patients. They found that there was a pronounced increase in the superoxide dismutase-like enzyme activity, one of the main antioxidant enzymes in the brain, in the nucleus substantia nigra of Parkinson's patients. The MPTP is actually the active component of an herbicide known as Cyperquat, which is used to kill nutsedge. Fortunately, the manufacturing division that was to make this herbicide closed down before it went to market. Chemically, it is related to the dangerous herbicide Paraquat, which has been shown to kill cells by producing enormous amounts of free radicals, which consume all of the cell's antioxidants. MPP Plus forms far fewer free radicals. What makes the MPTP story interesting is that there are many compounds found in nature that have a similar chemical structure. The part of the MPTP molecule that appears to be necessary for producing Parkinson's disease is also found in many plants. In fact, ordinary tea contains two such compounds. Thus far, tests have not implicated tea in Parkinson's disease, but the testing period may have been too short. However, there is no difference in the incidence of Parkinson's disease among the English, who regularly drink strong tea, and Americans. Scientists are now busy examining foods and plant derivatives for the presence of this compound or its relatives. Paralysis agitans, Parkinson's disease. In 1817, Dr. James Parkinson described a disease of the elderly in which there was a characteristic tremor during rest, stooped posture, and other neurological signs. Further experience disclosed other findings that were peculiar to the Parkinson's patient. For example, Parkinson's patients blink their eyes infrequently, have a mask-like expression, and develop movements that are rigid. It is as if they are struggling against their own muscles. Another finding is a loss of balance. Actually, this is an inability to stop a forward motion once it has begun. It is as if they are always trying to catch up with their centers of gravity. A tremor of their fingers while at rest is characteristic. When you see an elderly person sitting on a park bench with their hands resting on knees, involuntarily rolling their fingers in an imaginary circle, they may be victims of this disease. This is referred to as the pill-rolling tremor, because it looks as if they are rolling an invisible pill between their thumb and first finger. As the disease progresses, the person becomes more rigid and develops a stooped posture. Their walk is shuffling and unsteady. The disease also affects their handwriting and even their speech, causing their voice to lose much of its volume, so that it sounds like they are always whispering. This was one of the saddest things about my father's illness. Because I lived so far away from my parents, one of my greatest pleasures was talking to my father on the phone. But as his condition worsened, I could barely understand him, so I had to relay messages through my mother or via letters. Handwriting changes usually appear late in the disease, with the writing becoming small and almost illegible. This is called micrographia. I struggled through many of my father's letters, trying to make out the tiny, scrawled letters. Gradually, the disease robs the victim of most of life's pleasures. Toward the end, my father could barely get from the bed to his favorite chair, where he would sit, almost immobile, for hours. It wasn't until recently that doctors began to recognize that a significant number of Parkinson's patients become demented toward the end of their disease. Fortunately, my father was spared this indignity. In some series, it has been found that as many as 32% of Parkinson's patients develop dementia as part of their illness. The dementia is exactly like that seen with Alzheimer's disease. Some patients will also develop features of ALS as well. My father developed ALS symptoms. His hands became so weak that he could barely pick up even small objects. When you recall that all three diseases, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's dementia, and ALS, can be produced by the plant toxin in guam, one cannot be but surprised that doctors did not recognize this association before. But for years, medical textbooks treated these as three entirely separate diseases. Now let us look at the role of excitotoxins in the causation of Parkinson's disease. Excitotoxins and Parkinson's disease. Interestingly, MPTP is not an excitotoxin, but there is another drug that is an excitotoxin that can result in premature Parkinson's disease. This drug, amphetamine, and its analogs, is known by the drug faithful as uppers. It has been known for some time that amphetamines stimulate the nervous system and that frequently they precipitate a seizure. It is suspected that amphetamines produce brain damage by way of glutamate-type neural pathways. They not only excite certain brain cells, but also initiate calcium-triggered destructive reactions within specific neurons by way of NMDA-type receptors. By exciting the neurons, they speed up depletion of cellular energy molecules such as ATP and phosphocreatinine, thereby making the neurons even more vulnerable to all types of excitotoxins, including MSG. Amphetamines are known to cause specific destruction of a group of neurons that are concerned with controlling fine and coordinated movements of the arms and legs. This collection of neurons and their connecting fibers are referred to as the nigrostriatal system, which is the same nerve system destroyed in Parkinson's disease. Exactly how amphetamines destroy these neurons is not completely understood. There is some evidence that they stimulate the production of free radicals in these neurons. The nigrostriatal system also receives a large fiber input from the outer layer of cells of the brain, called the cortex. These fibers arise primarily from glutamate-type neurons, and it is through this cortical system that glutamate and amphetamines act to destroy the nigrostriatal system. Further proof comes from the observation that a powerful blocker of NMDA types of glutamate receptors can completely block amphetamine toxicity. Therefore, glutamate, amphetamines, and other excitotoxins may produce Parkinsonism by overexciting the cortical glutamate cells that connect to the nigrostriatal neurons lying deep in the brain. It is sort of like lightning hitting the power line outside your house and burning up all of the appliances connected to that line. The power line represents the cortical glutamate neurons, and the appliances, the nigrostriatal system. Further evidence comes from a recent observation involving one of the primary drugs used to treat Parkinson's disease, L-DOPA. While this drug has done much to relieve the crippling symptoms of this terrible disease, and even to extend the lifespan of younger patients, there is some evidence that it may speed up the progress of the disease. Several studies have indicated that patients started early on L-DOPA therapy tend to deteriorate faster than those in which other drugs were used initially. Part of the explanation of this phenomenon may lie in the findings of Dr. John Olney, who demonstrated that L-DOPA is a mild excitotoxin. It was found to be approximately half as potent as MSG. A metabolite of L-DOPA, called 6-hydroxydopa, is about 6 times more powerful than MSG. From this observation, it would be reasonable to assume that high doses of the Parkinson drug L-DOPA could kill off already weakened neurons in the nigrostriatal system, thereby speeding up the progress of the disease. Dr. Olney suggests that L-DOPA does not act alone, but rather acts with glutamate to produce the damage. This is one reason why persons with Parkinson's disease should avoid all foods and drinks containing excitotoxin additives such as MSG, hydrolyzed vegetable protein, cysteine, and aspartate, NutraSweet. While there is no proof that these toxins penetrate these sensitive areas, there is no proof that they do not. As we shall see, there is evidence that as we age, our blood-brain barrier system tends to weaken, allowing previously excluded molecules to enter the brain. Throughout life, especially as we age, we are exposed to conditions and diseases that can disrupt the barrier. This would allow glutamate and aspartate in the diet to reach these already weakened neurons and speed up their destruction. It should also be recalled that cysteine can easily penetrate the intact blood-brain barrier, and that hydrolyzed vegetable protein contains cysteine. Ganging up on neurons. Critics of this hypothesis state that if food toxins and additives were the cause of Parkinson's disease, why wouldn't all of us eventually develop the disease? That's a good question. Of course, I am not proposing that excitotoxin food additives are the primary cause of Parkinson's disease or any other neurodegenerative disease. A closer examination will give us several explanations. It is a well-recognized fact that there can be a considerable variation in sensitivity to a particular toxin, even within the same species of the same size and sex. This may be because of differences in the concentration and competency of protective enzymes, the efficiency of cellular energy production, and differences in absorption from the digestive system. Some humans can take enormous amounts of arsenic without becoming sick, while others will die at a fraction of the dose. There are also species differences in sensitivity to excitotoxins. For example, in case of amphetamines, we know that the rat, which has been used as the model for amphetamine toxicity, is much more resistant to the effects of the drug than are humans. The lethal dose of amphetamines in humans is much lower than in the rat. The lethal dose of amphetamine in humans is 7.5 milligrams per kilogram, while in rats, even a dose of 40 milligrams per kilogram is not lethal. Also, You may recall that humans accumulate higher blood levels of glutamate after a similar dose of MSG than does any other animal species. And human neurons are just as sensitive at the same doses of MSG as our animals. In fact, humans are much more sensitive to the toxic effects of MSG than our monkeys. There is a lot of individual variation in the vulnerability to these toxins between species of animals and even within the same species. Part of the explanation as to why everyone does not develop these diseases after chronic exposure to excitotoxins lies in the competence of the various protective mechanisms used to prevent glutamate accumulation around the neuron. Remember, there is a pumping system that shunts excess glutamate into the surrounding astrocytes. Refer to Chapter 4. If this system is very efficient, it takes enormous amounts of glutamate to produce brain lesions. But also remember, this system is extremely energy dependent. If, for some reason, the energy supply is reduced, the protective pump will fail and toxic amounts of glutamate will accumulate around the neurons. There is evidence that if we live long enough, a much larger percentage of us will indeed develop neurodegenerative diseases. In a recent survey of the incidence of Alzheimer's disease among the elderly, it was found that between the ages of 65 to 74, the incidence of the disease was 3%. Between the ages of 75 to 84, the incidence rose to 18.7%. And after age 85, it soared to 47.2%. The same may be true of ALS and Parkinson's disease. This steep rise in the incidence of these diseases could represent a combination of factors: an increased vulnerability of aged neurons to a multitude of environmental hazards, the natural attrition of aged neurons, a gradual failure of the protective mechanism with aging, and the accumulated action of years of excitotoxin exposure on weakened neurons. Other critics charge that even if large amounts of glutamate are consumed, the blood-brain barrier will keep the glutamate from entering the brain. Normally, this is true, but there are several conditions under which the blood-brain barrier system will fail, such as head injuries, viral and bacterial infections of the brain and spinal cord, hypertension, exposure to some metals such as lead and tin, and an elevated core body temperature. One of the most common reasons for a breakdown in this barrier is stroke. While major strokes, those that leave a person paralyzed on one side or with impaired speech, do occur frequently, much more often we see minor strokes. These may be so small that the person is not even aware that they have occurred. Usually they develop deep in the white matter of the brain and involve tiny blood vessels rather than major feeding arteries to the brain. We call these silent strokes. What makes them important is that they produce holes in the blood-brain barrier. These holes can act as leaks in the blood barrier that allow normally excluded proteins and other potentially toxic substances to enter the brain. Experimentally, we know that such leaks can allow normally excluded molecules, like glutamate, to seep in and eventually reach the entire brain. The older you get, the more likely these silent strokes are to develop. There is some evidence that as we age, the blood-brain barrier begins to break down, at least for the passage of some molecules. While it may still exclude the larger molecules, the smaller molecules, like the amino acids aspartate and glutamate, may get through. There is also evidence that as we age, the neurons within the nigrostriatal system slowly begin to die. In humans, by age 65, 60% of the cells are dead. But is this a natural attrition of these cells? There is some evidence that it may not be. For instance, we know that rats lose only 20% of their neurons during a comparable period of time. As humans, we eat a diet containing enormous amounts of excitotoxin food additives, and do so for decades, even a lifetime, whereas rats rarely have added excitotoxins, except in an experimental situation. It may be that this loss of neurons is the result of years of excitotoxin food additive exposure in humans, combined with other neurotoxic insults. Yet we would also expect aged neurons to be more vulnerable to toxins. There is evidence that aged monkeys are more susceptible to MPTP than younger animals. The drug kinate, a powerful glutamate receptor excitotoxin, will not damage neurons in immature animals, but will readily kill them in older animals. By the time we reach age 60, our neurons have undergone decades of trauma from a multitude of abuses, such as injuries, infections, stress, chemical toxins, drugs, heat, and, of course, foodborne excitotoxins. But there is a logical connection. Low blood sugar precipitates cerebral symptoms of anxiety, confusion, and even anger because the brain is denied its supply of energy-giving glucose. Remember, the brain consumes 25% of the total body glucose. Its needs are great. When this need is not met, various systems begin to malfunction. And one of these systems is the protective pumps used to maintain a stable, low concentration of glutamate and aspartate around the neurons. As doctors have found in experiments, low energy levels greatly enhance the toxicity of glutamate and the other excitotoxins, so that even normally low doses of excitotoxins can become toxic. This toxicity can manifest itself as anxiety or confusion, and as episodes of anger. Running out of fuel. As I have pointed out throughout this discussion of glutamate toxicity, the brain is most sensitive when its energy supply is low. It does not seem to matter what causes the low energy supply, hypoglycemia, poor blood supply to portions of the brain, or a failure of energy production by the cells themselves. There is some recent evidence that Parkinson's patients have a defect in their metabolism that leads to increased metabolism. Such a defect would make them more vulnerable to the harmful effects of excitotoxins. In one study, resting energy expenditure, the amount of energy being burned at rest, was measured in 14 elderly patients with Parkinson's disease and compared to 16 healthy control patients of similar ages. As a group, Parkinson's patients had metabolic rates significantly higher than the controls. This substantially increased energy requirement might explain the extreme weight loss frequently seen in Parkinson's patients. It is also common for the elderly to lose their appetites, especially with chronic debilitating diseases. As we age, our taste buds lose some of their function, making food often seem tasteless. Since many elderly live alone and have difficulty preparing their meals, it may become difficult for them to eat enough calories. With excitotoxin food additives being in virtually every manufactured food product, our brain is constantly being assaulted by excitotoxins. During a lifetime, many of us also experience many periods of hypoglycemia. Children frequently develop hypoglycemia during illness because they usually lose their appetites. Some of the medications they take also can lower blood sugar. Adults, especially in today's fat-conscious society, are constantly going on low-calorie diets and even starvation diets. Many of these diets call for foods low in carbohydrates, which may result in prolonged states of relative hypoglycemia. There is another condition which may produce rather profound states of hypoglycemia, exercise. Intense, prolonged exercise, especially in the untrained person, has been shown to cause severe drops in blood glucose. I remember when I first started going to the gym to exercise that after a hard workout I would have difficulty thinking clearly. I asked others and found out that they too suffered from this annoying problem. After research, I came upon several medical studies done on athletes which confirmed this post-exercise fall in blood sugar, which explains the severe muscle weakness and trembling most of us experience following strenuous exercise. Later, I came across an article in the newspaper on a marathon runner who was forced to quit the sport because of severe Parkinson's disease. He was totally incapacitated by his disease, and he admitted in the article that on several occasions he had suffered from heat exhaustion during marathon races. Under such conditions, two events can occur that can enhance excitotoxic damage to neurons: elevated body core temperature and hypoglycemia. During prolonged running, such as occurs during marathons and triathlons, the body core temperature can rise sufficiently to cause, at least based on experimental studies, a temporary breakdown of the blood barrier, which can result in leakage of glutamate and aspartate into the brain itself. Also, such physical stress can cause a prolonged fall in the blood glucose, and hence in brain glucose, which results in greater vulnerability of the brain to excitotoxins, both occurring naturally within the brain and those supplied by the diet. In addition, during extreme exercise, a tremendous number of free radicals are formed within the tissues as a result of increased metabolism. This too will add to the damage. In 1968, Dr. Kwok described a clinical condition caused by exposure to the MSG in Chinese food, in which the victim developed headaches, sweating, nausea, weakness, thirst, burning and tightness of the face, neck, and chest, abdominal pains, and sometimes diarrhea. This reaction to MSG was given the name the Chinese restaurant syndrome. But as Dr. Schwartz and others have shown, the syndrome is not limited to Chinese food. It is caused by exposure to high doses of MSG in any food. The defenders of the MSG industry claimed that this reaction was rare, and could be prevented by eating a diet containing carbohydrates. And indeed, it was shown that people's responses to MSG were highly variable. Some reacted to doses as low as 1 to 2 grams, while others required doses as high as 12 grams to produce the same reaction. Overall, about 10 to 25% of people eating a meal containing MSG developed these adverse physical reactions first described by Dr. Kwok. Yet when human volunteers fasted overnight and then were fed MSG alone, virtually all developed full-blown symptoms of the Chinese restaurant syndrome. So even moderate hypoglycemia plays a major role in magnifying the toxicity of these excitotoxins. One article defending MSG, written by the Glutamate Association in a popular magazine, claimed that MSG was not toxic, and then proceeded to state that toxicity was blocked by merely including the MSG in food. Yet their statement that food blocks MSG toxicity must mean that MSG is toxic. As for the blocking effect of mixed diets, McLaughlin and co-workers demonstrated that tube-fed rats developed equally high levels whether MSG was given in a water solution or mixed with a meat suspension. Another study found that MSG mixed with tomato juice produced a 20-fold rise in plasma glutamate in humans. And only in co-workers were able to produce typical hypothalamic injuries using a mixture of MSG with cow's milk. Stejink and his co-workers later disclosed that very high concentrations of sugar could block glutamate absorption sufficiently to prevent brain injury. In this study, they used 6 average human volunteers who ate beef consommé, containing 50 milligrams per kilogram body weight of MSG, either with or without sucrose. They found that sucrose significantly reduced the amount of glutamate absorbed into the plasma. What I find interesting is that they used a dose that would be equal to 10 of the packets of sugar that you use at your local diner. Is he suggesting that we eat 10 packets of sugar each time we are exposed to foods containing MSG or aspartame? If we did, our problem wouldn't be brain damage, it would be diabetes. In an earlier article, Stejink suggested that you could dramatically reduce glutamate absorption simply by eating starches. In this experiment, he found that you would have to eat an equivalent of 17 to 18 crackers to prevent significant plasma elevations of glutamate following a meal with 0.5 grams of MSG per kilogram of body weight. Who eats 18 crackers with every meal, snack, or before drinking a diet cola sweetened with aspartame? They found that when smaller amounts of starches were used, 5 out of 8 subjects had no protective effect afforded by the carbohydrates. It is obvious that sucrose or starches added to our diets do not afford adequate protection against excitotoxin food additives. The only protection is to avoid them altogether. Parkinsonism, a metabolic error in cellular energy production. One of the most exciting findings concerning this terrible disease is that patients with Parkinsonism seem to have an enzyme defect affecting only certain brain cells that prevents these neurons from producing adequate amounts of energy. Within all cells, including neurons, energy is supplied by the mitochondria, which occurs via a series of reactions involving various enzymes and chemicals called the electron transport system. The first and most critical step in this energy-producing process is called complex 1. Should this step be defective, which is thought to occur in Parkinsonism, the neurons become severely depleted of energy and as a result become extremely sensitive to excitotoxins, such as glutamate and aspartate. Dr. Shapira and his co-workers examined the brains of 9 patients who died while suffering from Parkinson's disease and found that all demonstrated a marked reduction in the complex 1 enzymes. But interestingly, these critical energy-supplying enzymes were deficient only in the neurons thought to be responsible for Parkinson's disease. Samples of neurons from other parts of the brain were normal. This indicated that for some unknown reason, the cells in the substantia nigra have defective complex 1 enzymes. In this study, they compared similar neurons from normal controls, matched for age and sex. A follow-up study of 7 additional Parkinson patients demonstrated similar findings, with a 42% reduction in complex 1 enzyme activity. This finding is important because it confirms earlier observations that glutamate toxicity is greatly magnified when cellular energy supplies are deficient. In essence, persons destined to develop Parkinson's disease appear to have an inherited weakness in the energy-producing enzymes in the mitochondria of the neurons and their substantia nigra. This makes these neurons highly susceptible to the effects of excitotoxins, such as glutamate and aspartate, both found normally within the brain, and that supplied in the diet as taste enhancers. Yet other neurons in the brain, having normal energy-producing enzymes, are not affected. This makes the destruction very specific. In the past, based on studies of identical twins, most authorities assumed that Parkinson's disease was not inherited. Since identical twins share the same chromosome structure, they should carry the same gene for Parkinson's disease. It is now known that there is another kind of inheritance, one determined by genetic material within the mitochondria. We know that when glutamate overstimulates a neuron, it can damage the mitochondrial genetic material, which would then pass on this altered gene to other cells. Such damaged mitochondrial genes could explain the unusual inheritance pattern of Parkinson's disease. Today, we are finding more and more diseases having a mitochondrial inheritance rather than the usual chromosomal inheritance. If Parkinson's disease is caused by excitotoxin damage to specific cells in the brain, then blocking excitotoxins should help protect Parkinson's patients from progression of the disease. There is some experimental evidence that this occurs. Doctors Thomas Klockgether and Lekoslav Tursky tested this hypothesis using a rat model of Parkinsonism and found that MK-801, a powerful drug that blocks the toxic effect of glutamate, did indeed offer significant improvement in symptoms as well as protection against the disease. They used low doses of the compound so as to prevent behavioral side effects, such as learning difficulties and drowsiness. Some of the drugs used to treat Parkinson's disease may be beneficial because they act by blocking glutamate toxicity. For example, the drug memantine has been shown to be a rather powerful glutamate receptor blocking agent, much like MK-801. It may be that one of these excitotoxin-blocking drugs will hold great promise in combating this terrible disease. As you have heard in the previous discussion, part of the damage caused by excitotoxins is secondary to the generation of free radicals within the neurons being stimulated. These free radicals are extremely reactive chemicals that injure many components within the cells, and if left unchecked, can result in cell death. Dr. D.T. Dexter and his co-workers studied the brains of several patients dying with Parkinson's disease and found that all demonstrated significant degrees of free radical damage within the substantia nigra. All other brain areas were normal. In fact, the level of MDA, a measure of free radical damage, was elevated 35% higher in Parkinsonism patients than normal controls matched for age. There is also evidence that free radicals can stimulate further release of excitotoxic amino acids in the injured areas of the brain. This produces a vicious cycle whereby excitotoxins stimulate free radical formation, and the free radicals in turn stimulate further excitotoxin accumulation. Under such conditions, it is the brain's natural antioxidant free radical scavengers that prevent the process from eventually killing the neurons. And there is some evidence that vitamins E and C, powerful free radical scavengers, can slow the progress of Parkinson's disease. Some neurologists have even suggested the use of vitamin E for all Parkinsonism patients. Dexter and co-workers have demonstrated that patients dying with Parkinson's disease also have very high levels of iron within the neurons of the substantia nigra. It has been shown that iron within tissues acts as a powerful stimulus for the production of free radicals. It appears that there is a direct connection between excitotoxin excess in the brain, low energy levels in the involved neurons, and a massive production of destructive free radicals. If left unchecked, the neurons within the substantia nigra nucleus will eventually die, causing all of the symptoms of Parkinson's disease to appear. How does Parkinson's disease develop? As yet, we do not know exactly how Parkinson's disease develops, but we are finding some important answers. We know that certain events occur in the Parkinson's patient. For example, we know that in Parkinson's patients, the substantia nigra nucleus, a small black pigmented clump of neurons located at the junction of the brainstem, contains more zinc, has higher levels of iron, impaired complex 1 function, evidence of severe free radical damage, and significantly lower levels of glutathione than in healthy brains. When we examine the brains of people dying of Parkinson's disease, we cannot tell which of these events occurred first. But a recent study has shed some light on this problem. It was found that 8-10% of the average population at postmortem, despite having been entirely free of Parkinson's symptoms during life, will have changes suggesting the earliest stages of the disease. The amount of dopamine in these individuals is entirely normal, as are the zinc and iron levels. The complex 1 activity in this nucleus was found to be only slightly reduced. The surprising finding was that the level of reduced glutathione was drastically low. Normal levels were found in aged matched controls and in people dying from other neurodegenerative diseases. So what is glutathione? It is a very important antioxidant enzyme that occurs in two forms, reduced and oxidized. It is by switching from the reduced form to the oxidized that this enzyme neutralizes free radicals. The level of reduced glutathione in this early preclinical stage of Parkinson's was as severely depleted as the level seen in the most advanced stages of the disease. Obviously, this represents one of the earliest stages of the disorder. What makes this important is that neurons with low levels of glutathione are highly susceptible to free radical injury, which can be initiated by excitotoxin attack. As the free radicals begin to accumulate within the neurons, they can further damage the complex 1 system, thereby severely impairing its generating capacity. This would create a situation of even higher vulnerability to excitotoxin injury. Parkinsonism and the dietary MSG connection. So, you may ask, what does all this have to do with MSG and other excitotoxins in my food? It appears that certain people are destined to develop Parkinsonism because of an inherited, via mitochondrial DNA, defect in critical energy-producing enzymes within the mitochondria. As a result of this energy failure, the neurons become highly and selectively vulnerable to damage by excitotoxins, occurring both naturally within the brain itself and from the diet. But, you say, the brain should be protected from excitotoxins in the food by the blood-brain barrier. Normally, this would be true. But, as I have pointed out, it appears that there are many conditions during which the blood-brain barrier can be temporarily broken down, such as with heat stroke, brain trauma, encephalitis, strokes, hypertension, and even severe hypoglycemia. Experimentally, it has been shown that special radioactively labeled MSG not only passes through the blood-brain barrier in neonatal animals, but it also accumulates in high concentrations in areas known to be damaged by MSG and other excitotoxins, such as the hippocampus, which is vital to recent memory function. This study demonstrated that the MSG entered the brain slowly, bypassing the blood-brain barrier, and reached peak concentrations in the brain 3 hours after the MSG was given. Even more important was the finding that the high levels of MSG in the brain remained for 24 hours after the dose was given. Disruptions of the blood-brain barrier could explain why most cases of Parkinson's disease occur in older age groups, that is, because they will have suffered a lifetime of insults to their blood-brain barrier. If these individuals are born with an energy deficit in the neurons of the substantia nigra, the excess excitotoxin load from their diet could speed up their rate of clinical deterioration. It could also explain one other phenomenon seen with Parkinson's disease, which has only recently been recognized. That is the finding of cases of Parkinson's disease in combination with clinical features of ALS and dementia. It is now recognized that about 1/3 of cases of Parkinsonism will eventually develop dementia of some degree. It may that as these Parkinson's patients age and develop small strokes, hypertension, or other diseases of the brain, their blood-brain barriers become more porous, allowing excitotoxins in the blood to enter. By ingesting diets high in MSG, hydrolyzed vegetable protein, aspartame, and other excitotoxins, these people would be exposing their brains to damaging levels of this class of toxin. Eventually, other neurons would be damaged, possibly leading to symptoms of Alzheimer's-type dementia and ALS. It is also possible that glutamate and aspartate can enter the brain without a breakdown in the blood-brain barrier. We know that certain areas of the adult brain have no or incompetent barriers. These areas are near the ventricular system, circumventricular organs, and can potentially act as points through which glutamate and aspartate in the plasma could slowly seep into the surrounding brain, thereby bypassing the blood-brain barrier. This would explain the delay in brain accumulation of radioactively labeled MSG following its injection in animals. Many meals served in restaurants contain very high doses of MSG and other excitotoxic amino acids. In fact, they equal or even exceed experimental doses that regularly produce brain lesions in animals. Remember, humans concentrate glutamate in their blood following a meal containing MSG higher than any other known species of animal. Even a single bowl of soup may contain several grams of MSG. Most salad dressings are loaded with MSG and hydrolyzed vegetable protein, also labeled as vegetable protein, as are croutons. If you use steak sauce, it frequently contains both, disguised as natural flavoring or spices. Chips, creamy sauces, some gravies, rice dishes, and other gourmet foods can all be loaded with excitotoxic taste enhancers. I believe that there is enough research evidence demonstrating the harmful effects of excitotoxins in food additives that all persons having a history of sensitivity to MSG or a strong family history of one of the neurodegenerative diseases should avoid all foods and beverages containing these excitotoxin taste additives. Doing so could mean the difference between a normal life and one spent suffering from a crippling disease. I will repeat these warnings throughout the book because they are so important. We must reprogram our eating habits to include fresh foods and excitotoxin-free beverages, at least until the food industry takes a responsible position on this most important issue. The role played by selective energy defects in nigrostriatal neurons is further emphasized by another observation seen in patients treated with certain tranquilizers, neuroleptics. It has been known for many years that 20 to 40% of patients treated chronically with these tranquilizers will develop Parkinsonism. One of the worst offenders is a drug known as haloperidol. Chemically, haloperidol closely resembles the neurotoxin MPTP, which can induce Parkinsonism in experimental animals and humans. MPTP is a powerful inhibitor of the complex 1 enzyme system in the mitochondria, which leads to severe energy deficits in these cells and the subsequent buildup of free radicals. Haloperidol has the same effect. It can inhibit the complex 1 system selectively. The magnitude of reduction of complex 1 activity in the platelets was found to be 42% of normal in persons taking neuroleptic medications and 46% in patients with Parkinson's disease, indicating that they inhibit this energy system to a similar degree. The concentrations of the neuroleptics medications necessary to depress complex 1 activity correlated directly with the dose needed to produce Parkinson's-like side effects in patients. It is also known that the melanin in the neurons of the substantia nigra tends to concentrate these drugs, thereby exposing them to selective complex 1 inhibition and sparing other areas of the brain. This would also make these energy-deprived neurons selectively hypersensitive to excitotoxin damage. There is another bit of evidence that points to excitotoxins as a major contributor in the causation of Parkinsonism. A recent analysis of Parkinson's patients disclosed that the loss of neurons is a linearly progressive pathologic process. This means that the number of neurons lost is the same every year. Such evidence is not compatible with a disease that suddenly accelerates or decelerates from year to year. Of all environmental exposures, the one that would most exactly meet such criteria would be a foodborne toxin eaten every day. The excitotoxin food additives would certainly fulfill such a requirement. One would expect neuron loss under such exposure to be rather uniform. Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease. Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, is a neurodegenerative disease that primarily affects the anterior horn cells of the spinal cord. These are the primary neurons in the spinal cord that control muscle movements of the body. But these neurons do not operate by themselves. Rather, they are controlled from higher up in the brain by other neurons in the motor cortex, which send fibers down the spinal cord that in turn connect, synapse, with the anterior horn cells. This bundle of fibers from the cortex is called the corticospinal tract. In most cases of ALS, these neurons are also affected. Some have proposed that ALS is really many diseases. This is because it can be present in many different forms. While most cases first appear after age 40, sometimes it strikes in the 20s or even teens. Most cases progress relentlessly for 3 to 5 years until the victim dies of respiratory failure or a related complication. But other cases seem to stabilize for decades. Dr. Stephen Hawkins, the astrophysicist, apparently has this form of the disease. Rarely, we see cases that progress very rapidly to death within a year. The clinical presentation also varies. Some develop weakness first in the muscles of the face, while most begin with weakness in the muscles of the hands. This weakness slowly progresses up the arms. Still other cases affect primarily the legs, and instead of the usual flaccid weakness, they experience spasticity and rigidity of the legs. Almost all cases spare sensation in the arms and legs and do not involve the mind. That the mind remains clear until the very end is one of the features that makes the disease particularly horrible. Another unusual characteristic is that while most cases of ALS occur sporadically, some are definitely inherited. In one study of a Dutch family, researchers found the appearance of ALS in 6 generations. In these cases, the onset of the disease was earlier and the progression was more rapid than normal. Similar cases have been reported throughout the medical literature. The excitotoxin hypothesis is able to explain many of these variables. As we have seen with Parkinson's disease, there are many factors at play in determining sensitivity to excitotoxins. For example, heredity plays a role in controlling enzymes that either generate energy for the neuron or protect it from dangerous accumulations of free radicals or excitotoxins. Other factors would include the integrity of the blood-spinal cord barrier, similar to the blood-brain barrier, the effects of aging on the neurons, and exposure to other toxins such as aluminum. All of these variables could account for differences in not only clinical patterns, but incidences of the disease. As we have heard at the beginning of this chapter, a known plant toxin can produce a disease that is clinically indistinguishable from spontaneously occurring amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS. The only pathological difference is the presence of numerous neurofibrillary tangles, microscopic fibrous bodies arranged as paired helical filaments seen in degenerating neurons, throughout the nervous system in the case of the Guam disease. Spencer has pointed out that this may be the result of the type of toxin and not as a specific consequence of the disease itself. This is further supported by the observation that even those who do not develop the clinical disease also have numerous neurofibrillary tangles throughout their nervous systems. In 1987, Dr. Andreas Pleitikas and James T. Carocio reported that 22 patients they selected as having early signs of ALS responded differently to dietary glutamate than did normal controls in patients with other neurological diseases. When they fed these patients MSG in a dose of 60 milligrams per kilogram after the patients had fasted overnight, they found that the ALS patients' blood glutamate levels were twice as high as compared to the control normal patients and persons having other neurological diseases. Not only were their blood glutamate levels grossly elevated, but so were their aspartate levels, while the blood levels of other amino acids were all normal. But then they found something even more astounding. Even during the early stages of their disease, when fasting, these ALS patients have serum glutamate levels that are 100% higher than normal persons under the same conditions. When these patients ate normal mixed meals containing protein, their glutamate levels also rose significantly higher than normal persons. It was obvious that these patients had a defect in their ability to metabolize glutamate. A related disorder called atypical ALS is known to have a defect in the enzyme glutamate dehydrogenase, which causes glutamate from even a normal meal to accumulate in high levels in the blood and the nervous system. It is known that the corticospinal neurons, and possibly the anterior horn cells, are glutamate-type neurons, thus making them sensitive to damage by high levels of glutamate and aspartate. Others have measured glutamate levels in ALS patients and have not found elevated levels. But Dr. Pleitikas points out that glutamate is very difficult to measure in the serum and must be done under very exacting conditions. His review of the negative reports indicates that these precautions have not been used in these previous studies. In a follow-up study, Dr. Pleitikas and his co-workers examined the glutamate and aspartate levels from the cerebellar cortex, frontal lobe, and two areas of the spinal cord in patients dying of ALS. They found that glutamate levels were significantly decreased, 21-40% lower than controls, in all areas tested. The cervical and lumbar cord, the areas containing the greatest number of motor neurons, showed the greatest deficit. Aspartate was significantly decreased in the spinal cord, only 32-35%. This defect in the aspartate and glutamate pools in the brains and spinal cords of ALS patients could indicate that these specialized neurons are destroyed and, as a result, have lost their previously high concentrations of these excitatory amino acids. One argument against this hypothesis is that the blood-spinal cord barrier should effectively exclude the glutamate and aspartate in the blood from entering the spinal cord. Again, as with the blood-brain barrier, this is hypothetically true. But we know essentially nothing about the ongoing competence of this barrier from day to day and minute to minute. As with any barrier, it will tend to fail under certain conditions. For example, excessive physical stress, elevated body core temperature, infections, trauma, certain drugs and metals, and aging itself may all alter the competence of this barrier. Remember, blood glutamate levels are always elevated in persons subject to ALS, day and night, and even when they have not eaten meals containing high glutamate compounds. When they eat foods containing MSG, their blood levels rise much higher than following normal meals. But what is most important is that their highest blood level occurs following ingestion of MSG. Apparently, persons destined to develop ALS have difficulty metabolizing ingested glutamate. If they eat any food containing glutamate or aspartate, their blood levels of this toxic amino acid become extremely elevated. Should they eat food manufactured in the United States, most likely it will contain a multitude of excitotoxins, most notably aspartate and glutamate in various forms. I would estimate that the typical American diet contains anywhere from 10 to 20 grams of excitotoxins a day. Some individuals will consume much higher amounts. A study done in Korea found that the average per capita consumption of MSG was 4 grams a day, with some individuals consuming as much as 120 grams in a 24-hour period. This is an enormous amount of neurotoxins, even for those able to metabolize glutamate normally. From Dr. Spencer's studies on LBMAA, we learned that ALS was most common in the experimental animals exposed to massive doses of this excitotoxin. Parkinson's disease occurred with lower doses spread over a longer period of exposure. This is most likely why people with the inherited enzyme defect, glutamate dehydrogenase, develop ALS and not Parkinson's disease, because they are exposed to more massive doses of the excitotoxins. A recent finding shed new light on this terrible disease. Dr. Jeffrey Rothstein, working at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, found that ALS patients have a deficiency of glutamate transporter proteins. These are special proteins that transport free glutamate from the fluid surrounding the neurons, extracellular space, into surrounding astrocytes. Remember, free glutamate in the extracellular space can kill the neurons. This removal process occurs very rapidly under normal conditions. Loss of the glutamate transporter is a specific defect thus far seen only in ALS. Dr. Rothstein found that when he applied a drug known to block the glutamate transporter to a spinal cord slice in a culture, glutamate levels rose to high levels that persisted for weeks. During this time, the neurons appeared normal. Then he began to see a process of slow death among the motor neurons, the neurons destroyed in ALS. From this data, it appears that ALS is a disease in which the glutamate transporter protein is lost, for some unknown reason, leading to chronic rise in glutamate within the spinal cord. This high concentration of glutamate will eventually destroy the large motor neurons in the spinal cord. But as yet, we do not know what causes the glutamate transporter to disappear suddenly. There is a rare familiar form of ALS, in which there is a defect in the antioxidant enzyme, superoxide dismutase, SOD, within the motor neurons of the spinal cord. When neurons have their SOD enzymes lowered experimentally to levels that are not very toxic and are then exposed to glutamate, one sees massive destruction of these motor cells. This again demonstrates the interplay between free radicals and glutamate toxicity. It appears that ALS is a disease caused primarily by a rise in intrinsic glutamate rather than ingested glutamate. But I would caution those with the disease that it would be foolhardy to expose yourself to additional excitotoxins at such a critical time. We do not know what part food additive excitotoxins play in the progress of this disease, but extreme caution would be advised. It is entirely possible that foodborne glutamate and aspartate may accelerate the disease process. A second bit of the growing evidence that excitotoxins play a major role in ALS is based on studies of a related disorder called olivopontocerebellar atrophy, or OPCA for short. Inherited glutamate sensitivity. Olivopontocerebellar degeneration is a rare inherited condition that can appear anywhere from age 12 to 52, with 38 as the average age of onset. Most cases eventually develop a severe loss of balance, ataxia, spasticity of the legs, and Parkinson's-type symptoms. What makes this disease especially interesting is that it represents a neurodegenerative disease caused by an inborn defect in an important enzyme. This enzyme, known as glutamate dehydrogenase, GDH, plays a vital role in converting glutamate, the excitotoxin, into glutamine, the inactive storage form of glutamate. Studies of patients with OPCA demonstrate that their white blood cells and fibroblasts, special cells in the skin, are deficient in glutamate dehydrogenase. This indicates that all of the cells in their body are deficient in this important enzyme, and not just the neurons in the nervous system. In one study of OPCA patients, it was found that after an overnight fast, their blood glutamate levels were twice as high as that seen in normal people. And after eating a normal meal containing 1 gram of protein, they had a marked elevation in both glutamate and aspartate. But even more importantly, when they were fed pure MSG in a dose of 60 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, their glutamate levels rose 3 times higher than that of a normal person. At this blood level, the glutamate concentration was equal to that used to produce neurological lesions in experimental animals. The brain normally contains glutamate concentrations 1,000 times higher than that found in the serum. The GDH, glutamate dehydrogenase, enzyme keeps this level rather stable by shifting any excess glutamate into the astrocyte, where it is converted into glutamine. When GDH is deficient, glutamate can attain levels high enough to cause serious brain or spinal cord injury, which is, in fact, what produces the severe but selective destruction of the brain seen in OPCA. What this disease demonstrates is the enormous destructive power of excitotoxins when they are allowed to accumulate in the brain and spinal cord. There is little question that individuals with this disorder should be especially careful to avoid excitotoxins in their food. And with the new FDA rules that allow food manufacturers to disguise the various forms of glutamate and other excitotoxins, this is becoming ever more difficult to do. Some doctors, unaware of this important connection, do not warn their patients to avoid these food additives. It is also important to note that in OPCD, high blood levels of glutamate following a meal do indeed pass through the blood-brain barrier, and should that happen, it would produce severe brain damage in areas thought to be protected by this barrier. One important point needs to be made at this juncture. Most of these terrible neurological diseases represent the full genetic expression of the disorder. But often, especially in hereditary diseases, rather than the full-blown disease, one may see incomplete genetic expressions of the disorder, which would produce only minor weakness in the cells and their enzymes. As a result, these diseases may never present with obvious clinical symptoms. This is because, as in the case of OPCA, the enzyme defect is not total, so that enough enzyme exists to prevent severe glutamate accumulation, if only low doses of glutamate and aspartate are eaten. But these individuals cannot tolerate the extremely high levels of glutamate or aspartate seen in many commercially prepared foods. The extra excitotoxin, as MSG, hydrolyzed vegetable protein or natural flavoring, taxes the enzyme system beyond its limits. There are quite possibly thousands of people walking around in a perfectly normal state of health who have a weakness for one of these inherited neurodegenerative diseases. High levels of MSG, or one of the other excitotoxins, could tip the scales and precipitate the full-blown disease, which is an excellent reason to avoid all excitotoxin food additives. Prevention of ALS. The ultimate aim of our research into the cause of ALS is not only to treat existing cases, but to prevent the disease altogether. This is not an unreasonable goal. More than likely, we will eventually discover that the neurons affected by this disease are also deficient in energy production, thus making them infinitely more susceptible to excitotoxin damage. The anterior motor neurons in the spinal cord are the largest neurons in the nervous system, and naturally would require large amounts of energy to sustain them. A combination of GDH deficiency, causing high blood and spinal cord glutamate concentrations, glutamate transporter loss, and energy deficiency of the neurons themselves, would put such an individual at high risk for developing the disease. It is also for this reason that persons with a strong family history of ALS should be very careful to exclude all food additive excitotoxins, such as MSG and hydrolyzed protein, from their food. This will require that you prepare most of your food fresh. You must also avoid all foods and drinks sweetened with aspartame, NutraSweet, since it contains the powerful excitotoxin aspartate. In addition, all that we have learned about hypoglycemia and Parkinson's disease also applies to ALS patients. Low energy levels greatly magnify the toxic effect of MSG and aspartate on the spinal cord. It should also be recalled that excitotoxins produce much of their damage by unleashing free radicals within the neurons. Out of all the therapies tried in ALS patients, the most successful have been those using antioxidants, such as vitamin E, and dietary supplements that increase cellular glutathione levels. It has been shown that when individuals with ALS are given large doses of L-leucine, one of the branched-chained amino acids, they significantly improve their neurological function and the progress of the disease is slowed. It is known that L-leucine is an important inducer of the glutamate inactivating enzyme GDH. In one study, 22 patients with ALS were used in a clinical trial, double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled, in which they were given branched-chained amino acids in large doses. These are given together to prevent interference in absorption. The control ALS patients were fed unsupplemented meals and showed a progressive decline in their neurological function, whereas those treated with branched-chain amino acids showed a significant slowing in their deterioration, especially toward the end of 1 year. Finally, it is important that the diet contains foods that have significant amounts of magnesium, such as broccoli and spinach. I would go so far as to recommend magnesium supplements, as magnesium lactate or gluconate, to those at risk and with the early stages of the disease. It is also important to have an adequate supply of zinc-containing foods in the diet. I would, however, be cautious about using high-dose zinc supplements, since there is evidence that although zinc totally blocks the NMDA type of glutamate toxicity, it may enhance toxicity at the non-NMDA sites. Certainly one should not take more than 25 to 50 milligrams of zinc more often than 3 times a week. These recommendations in no way imply that you can cure ALS or even totally prevent it from occurring merely by avoiding excitotoxin food additives or by taking supplements. But it is entirely possible that these measures may slow down the progress of the disease and may in some instances delay the onset of the disease in susceptible individuals. In the future, special drugs may be designed which can attain these lofty goals. Huntington's chorea. In 1872, Dr. George Huntington, a general practitioner from Pomery, Ohio, read a paper before the Academy of Medicine in which he reported several cases given to him by his father and grandfather from their practices. What he described was an unusual neurological disease that affected patients by suddenly appearing around middle age. Before the onset of this disease, the patients usually had led perfectly normal and healthy lives. Characteristically, the disease began with jerking movements of the face and then the arms, followed by a relentless deterioration of neurological function, so that the patients were eventually bedridden as writhing, disoriented, and demented cripples. Eventually, studies determined that this disorder originated from a single genetic mutation occurring in a family living in the tiny village of Bewers in Suffolk, England. From this lone family, 6 descendants immigrated to North America in 1630 and account for all known cases of the disease today, as the story goes. The onset of the disorder usually begins subtly with changes in mental ability and personality. Early on, one may see irritability, eccentric and even psychotic behavior, and difficulty with memory. Eventually, the mental abilities begin to fail. For example, these individuals may be unable to identify the names of common objects or to remember the names of close friends. This may go on for years and even precede the more obvious motor symptoms. The first motor signs to develop may be a twitching of the muscles of the face and shoulders. At first, this may be put off as nervousness or fidgeting. Gradually, this evolves into obvious writhing and jerking movements of the face and limbs, until finally the entire body is contorted by uncontrollable waves of spasm-like writhing called choreiform movements. All attempts at normal movement are grossly exaggerated, especially the facial expression, which may resemble grotesque grimacing. I'm sure there are some listeners who are now feeling a sudden twitch of the eye or jerk of the neck. Don't worry. This condition is inherited as an autosomal dominant trait, which means that you should know if one of your ancestors had the disorder. Besides, it is a very rare condition. This disease has its onset in 2 age groups. One group has an onset from age 15 to 40 years, and the other from age 55 to 60 years. Those having an earlier onset usually end up more severely impaired. Most patients eventually die after 10 to 15 years of unrelenting progression. At the end, they are usually bedridden and mentally incapacitated. I recall that during my sophomore year in medical school, one of my first patients was a 33-year-old nurse who had developed the disease shortly after her marriage and at the beginning of her nursing career. I recall so well standing by her bed, looking down at this writhing mass of emaciated skin and bones, horrified at the thought that at one time this was a normal, vibrant, pretty young nurse with her whole life ahead of her. I was overwhelmed with a feeling of helplessness before nature. When the brain of an individual dying with Huntington's disease is removed at autopsy and cut crosswise and examined, we see some very characteristic changes in its internal structure. Most noticeable is the fact that the paired nuclei lying adjacent to the frontal horn of the ventricles, called the caudate, putamen, and globus pallidus, are badly shrunken from degeneration. Collectively, these nuclei are called the basal ganglion or striatum. For the purpose of this discussion, I will simply refer to these nuclei as the striatum. The striatum plays a vital role in stereotyped movements, such as swinging the arms, and certain complex patterns of arm and leg movements that are fairly automatic. These movements are already pre-programmed within the striatum so that you do not have to figure out how to perform them each time they are needed. If we examine the striatum of a typical Huntington's disease patient under the microscope, we will see that not all of the neurons in the striatum are destroyed. Rather, the most severe loss is to the small and intermediate-sized neurons, with almost complete sparing of the larger neurons. We will see some neuron loss in the frontal cortex as well. So, once again, we see that the damage is very specific, wiping out some neurons and sparing others that are close by. While scientists have been unable to produce an exact model of Huntington's disease, they have come close. Thus far, only one class of chemicals can produce the type of selective damage that we see in human Huntington's disease. These chemicals are excitotoxins. In earlier research, it was found that two excitotoxins could produce this characteristic pattern of neuron loss in the striatum: quinolinic acid, a byproduct of tryptophan metabolism, and the experimental drug kinate. Both of these act on glutamate receptor-type neurons, just as MSG does. Kinate is what we call a glutamate agonist. That means it acts like glutamate. Yet kinate is a much more powerful excitotoxin than is glutamate. We know that the striatum contains the highest number of kinate-type receptors of any part of the brain. This is followed by the cerebral cortex and the hippocampus of the temporal lobes. Injection of kinate into the striatum produces many similarities to the changes seen in human cases of the disease, such as sparing of the large neurons in the nucleus. Neurochemical studies in patients dying of Huntington's disease demonstrate a 50-70% reduction in kinate-binding sites in the caudate and putamen. The same thing is seen in experimental studies following kinate injection of the striatum in animals. The problem with experimental studies is that rats do not develop the characteristic writhing movements seen in human cases of the disorder, called chorioathetosis. But they do develop some of the psychological changes seen in Huntington's disease. For example, rats will develop impaired learning of mazes, have altered daily activity, and exhibit abnormal feeding behavior, all of which indicate profound interference with mental function. But there are problems with the kinate hypothesis. Mainly, kinate is not normally found in nature. Also, while many of the kinate receptors are lost in the striatum, they are not the main ones damaged. Recent studies have shown that 93% of the NMDA receptors in the striatum are lost in Huntington's disease. A better candidate is quinolinic acid, the metabolite of the amino acid L-tryptophan. Injection of quinolinic acid into the striatum produces the same sparing of the large neurons, but more closely resembles the other pathological and neurochemical changes seen in the disease. It specifically kills glutamate neurons of the NMDA type. Both of these excitotoxins drain the energy from neurons when injected into the brain. Experimental studies using mice demonstrate that when kinate is injected into the striatum, ATP and phosphocreatine energy molecules fall to drastically low levels. Lactate levels, a measure of impaired energy metabolism, doubled, and glucose levels fell nearly 50% following kinate injection. This emphasizes the important role played by neuron energy requirements in this type of excitotoxin damage. Similar changes can be seen in studies of living Huntington's disease patients utilizing the PET scanner. This instrument allows scientists to observe the metabolism of the living brain. In the past, studies of the brain's metabolism required either neurochemical analysis of brain tissue taken soon after death, or the observation of isolated brain tissue in culture. Both of these methods were fraught with errors, the worst of which was the fact that one could not study how the brain metabolizes substances in everyday circumstances. The PET scanner allows us to observe the functioning of the brain by watching it metabolize special radioactive substances, such as radio-labeled glucose, 2,11-C-deoxy-D-glucose. In one such study, scientists observed the metabolism of Huntington's disease patients in which the disease had developed from age 17 to 71. They found that the degree of hypometabolism, low brain metabolism, varied directly with the stage of the disease. That is, patients having advanced deterioration showed the lowest levels of glucose metabolism in the striatum. They used the CT scanner, which gives a structural image of the brain's interior, to determine the degree of advancement of the disease. We would expect advanced cases to have low metabolism in the striatum, since the CT scanner showed this nucleus to be severely shrunken in such cases. But what surprised these scientists is that low metabolism could be detected even in cases showing no obvious shrinkage of the striatum. In fact, they demonstrated low metabolism in the striatum even in persons at risk for eventually developing the disease, but who had none of the symptoms or signs of the disease. In a follow-up study of 15 of these high-risk patients, they found that 3 out of 4 with the most advanced hypometabolism did eventually develop the full-blown disease. Again, this emphasizes that these neurodegenerative diseases begin long before clinical symptoms develop, and that impaired energy supplies to the neurons plays a vital role in this toxicity. Doctors Olney and Degubarev have proposed that in Huntington's disease, there is a defect in glutamate reuptake, the normal elimination of glutamate by the brain. If this were true, glutamate would accumulate in the striatum in concentrations that could kill striatal neurons. Others have proposed the idea that in Huntington's, there is a defect in the membrane of the neurons within the striatum that makes them especially sensitive, and therefore vulnerable to excitotoxin damage. Whatever the mechanism, there is a high probability that excitotoxins play a vital role in the final expression of this enigmatic disease. If this hypothesis is valid, then it may be possible that one can delay the onset, or even prevent the onset, of this disease by excluding excitotoxins from the diet. Most likely, it would also require the use of excitotoxin-blocking substances and drugs to prevent the glutamate within the brain from causing damage. But it is obvious to even the casual listener that it is especially important for those at risk, or in the early stages of the disease, to avoid excitotoxins in their food and to follow all of the other precautions outlined in my discussion of Parkinson's disease. The reason I included this rare disease in the discussion of excitotoxins is that it once again demonstrates the importance of these toxins in producing known neurodegenerative disease. And it also points out a recurring pattern seen with excitotoxin accumulation. Energy deficiency in the brain, impaired neuroprotective mechanisms, low magnesium, and high calcium accumulation in the neurons involved.